I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. Ukrainian officials said Tuesday that Ukraine and the U.S. have agreed on the framework for an economic deal. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Three senior Ukrainian officials say Kyiv and Washington have agreed on the outlines of a broad economic deal. The deal would include exploitation of Ukraine's rare earth minerals. One official says the hope is signing the deal would ensure U.S. military aid keeps flowing. President Trump has said he wants access to the minerals, which include lithium and titanium. China is the world's biggest rare earth element producer, and the U.S. and Europe have been trying to reduce dependence on Beijing. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A federal judge on Tuesday gave the Trump administration less than 2 days to release billions of dollars in U.S. foreign aid. AP correspondent Lisa Dwyer reports.
The judge says the administration has given no sign of complying with his nearly two-week-old court order to ease its funding freeze. The nonprofits involved in the lawsuit say that the administration has stiffed them on billions of dollars in money already owed. The cutoff followed an executive order by President Donald Trump targeting what he says are wasteful programs that do not correspond to his foreign policy goals. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
A federal judge in Seattle has blocked President Trump's effort to halt the nation's refugee admission system. The ruling came Tuesday in a lawsuit brought by major refugee aid groups who argued that Trump's executive order suspending the federal refugee resettlement program ran afoul of the system Congress created for moving refugees into the U.S. This is VOA News. Some U.S. states are welcoming recently laid off federal workers to apply for local jobs. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul.
The federal government might say you're fired, but here in New York, we say you're hired. In fact, we love federal workers. Whatever your skills, we value public service.
Hochul did not make clear if federal workers would get a leg up, but Hawaii says it has an expedited hiring process, fast-tracking qualified candidates laid off from federal jobs or cut because of a loss of federal funding. And New Mexico says it has a dedicated resource page to connect federal workers who lost their jobs with immediate opportunities. I'm Julie Walker.
As the Trump administration seeks to slash government spending, many American farmers are facing a financial crunch. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Some programs and grants that farmers depend on have been halted as a result of the president's federal funding freeze ahead of an important spring thaw.
For farmers to be told, we're not sure if we're going to have that program or we're not sure if we're going to be able to pay on this grant, is devastating. You know, like a lot of these programs work as upfront money.
Milo Petrucciello is a policy director at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association. He and others told Reuters at a recent organic farming conference in Wisconsin that farmers are feeling the pressure amid Trump's government overhaul. One Wisconsin-based nonprofit focused on investing in farmers, which had been awarded a federal grant supporting small farms, was recently told that the grant was suddenly terminated. Sadie Willis is the nonprofit's network coordinator.
We've already heard from some of our farmer committee members that they're now going to have to seek off-farm jobs in order to support themselves, which is really unfortunate because it's a direct impact that we can draw back to the funding having been cut from us that we can now no longer pass on to them.
Organic farmers and organizations are expected to meet with legislators on March 4th to push for more supportive policies.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. The Vatican says that Pope Francis remains in critical but stable condition. Vatican officials say that his blood tests are stable as he battles double pneumonia while continuing to work from the hospital. The Vatican's evening update said the 88-year-old Pope underwent a follow-up CAT scan on Tuesday evening to check the lung infection. Doctors said he hadn't had any further respiratory crises and that his prognosis remained guarded. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Britain plans to pause some bilateral aid to Rwanda over Kigali's role in the conflict in neighboring DRC.
You can put all the sanctions you want on Rwanda. Rwanda can do nothing. What you can do is to ensure that that cost does not exist anymore, which means you can encourage the government of the DRC to negotiate with them to anything.
The UN again expresses concern over the humanitarian crisis and loss of life in eastern DRC. Malawi vendors marched to parliament and stoned the ministers amid economic crisis. Canada's immigration overhaul signals a global shift in student migration. Sudan's RSF paramilitary group explains the details behind the new parallel government.
We plan to form this government to bring peace, either by negotiated solutions, which always preferable for us, but also by imposing peace through strengthening our military capabilities and practice our natural rights to defend our people.
And polls find Ukrainians battling fatigue and uncertainty, but also feeling hopeful. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Britain on Tuesday said it would pause some bilateral aid to Rwanda and impose other diplomatic sanctions on Kigali over its role on the conflict in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, according to Reuters. Rwanda denies backing the M23 group, but says its own troops are acting in self-defense against the hostile groups based in the DRC. Thierry Gatete Rumuliza is a Rwandan lawyer and senior fellow at the Institute of Political Analysis and Research. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that sanctioning Rwanda will not end the conflict in DRC.
You can put all the sanctions you want on Rwanda. Rwanda can do nothing. What you can do is to ensure that that cost does not exist anymore, which means you can encourage the government of the DRC to negotiate with M23. But in fact, they don't even have to negotiate because the demands of M23 are clear. Stop collaborating with FDLR. Stop the hate speech in the DRC against Tutsi and repatriate just under 1 million Congolese Tutsi who are in refugee camps in Uganda and in Rwanda to their home state in Congo, previously occupied by FDLR and now occupied by M23. Those are the demands. They are legitimate, they are clear, they are simple. Now, the government of Rwanda can decide today to say we officially denounce M23. It's not going to affect support to M23 by Rwandan people. M23 has direct relatives in Rwanda, has refugee camps in Rwanda, in Europe, in France, and everywhere. M23 is very supported. The rhetoric of Americans and Brits and so on is not going to affect their success on the ground. And now, M23, it seems, is also receiving direct support from Congolese. So how can you sanction Rwanda and expect the problem of the M23 to go away?
So in your view, the pressure from the US, the now UK, may have no impact on the Rwanda government as far as alleged support
for M23? It will have an impact on the Rwandan. Sanctions never affect the leaders of a country. I was speaking to Afande, James Kabarebe. I called him and said, Afande, what will happen of your Tesla shares and Google shares? He laughed because he has none. He doesn't have any assets in the U.S. Freezing Kabarebe's assets in the U.S., which assets? Kabarebe is a retired general, now turned politician, who manages regional affairs. He has nothing to do with M23.
In your view, these sanctions will not have an impact on the conduct of the Rwandese government?
It will have an impact on the Rwandan people. I'm sure this sanction is money for maybe HIV/AIDS programs or some NGO programs and things like that. Money will have an impact on that, of course. There's no doubt about it. But what's the alternative? No Rwandan citizen will go on the streets to protest against the Rwandan government for having brought to them sanctions. We really appreciate this aid money, but we never really give it more importance than it actually does have. We are Rwandan citizens. We are inherently ready to live on our own within our means.
Do you see Tshisekedi government collapsing as a result of this?
Kinshasa? I don't. For self-preservation, I believe that Kinshasa is ultimately going to negotiate. Because after cutting the aid, that's it. We're done. They don't have any more points to come up with at the table. The European aid is the last bit. But remember, the moment you cut that aid, that's it. There's no more point. So M23 will achieve its goals irrespective of anybody's. Rwanda, which was the mediator between the international community and M23, will stop doing that role.
Thierry Gatete Ruhumuliza is a Rwandan lawyer and a senior fellow at the Institute of Political Analysis and Research. He spoke from Kigali with Douglas Umpuga. The United Nations has again expressed concern over the humanitarian crisis and the loss of life in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric spoke during Monday's press briefing.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, our humanitarian colleagues tell us that in the Masisi territory in North Kivu province in the east, fighting has now claimed the lives of at least 4 civilians and injured 15 others, as well as disrupting humanitarian deliveries, humanitarian assessment in the area, In South Kivu, local officials say the schools in Kalehe territory, about 65 kilometers north of Bukavu, are gradually reopening. Schools had closed several weeks ago as fighting exposed children and teachers to massive human rights violations. At the same time, our partners report that unexploded ordnances remain a problem in many areas affected by recent fighting, including 2 schools in Minova, north of Bukavu. Our OCHA stresses that all parties to the conflict in the eastern DRC must uphold international humanitarian law at all times, protecting civilians and civilian infrastructure. And during a press conference in Juba yesterday, Jean-Pierre Lacroix, the head of our Peace Operations Department, expressed concern over the humanitarian crisis and loss of life in the DRC, stressing that there is no military solution to this crisis, and reiterating that while it is encouraging to see progress and involvement from stakeholders, their priority is the cessation of hostilities, implementation of decisions from the Luanda process, and ensuring humanitarian access. He added that the mission faces limitation in areas that is currently controlled by the M23, but continues to protect civilians and reduce violence in other areas, safeguarding hundreds of thousands of civilians daily. Mr. Lacroix also noted that if hostilities cease, the UN stands ready to actively support a ceasefire.
UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric speaking Monday during a press briefing. An official of Sudan's Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, says that one goal of the parallel government formed recently in Kenya is to address the humanitarian needs of the over 20 million Sudanese living in RSF-controlled areas. The RSF and other groups signed an agreement last week to form a governing administration. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that the move could lead to further escalation of the nearly two-year-old brutal civil war. Ezzedine El Safi is the RSF Senior Advisor for Peace and Humanitarian Affairs. He tells me that while there have been human rights abuses during the war, the RSF has taken steps to deal with those committing the abuses.
This charter aims, of course, to address the root causes of wars, put a solid ground for durable peace, and on top of that, address the humanitarian catastrophe that millions of Sudanese people are facing right now. The majority of them live in RSF area after had been deprived from having this assistance deliberately by SAF. And also represent a major leap towards the formation of a temporary government, a government of peace and unity that this coalition plans to form in the near future.
Some people say that you are trying to further divide Sudan by this agreement. What do you have to say to that?
We plan to form this government to bring peace, either by negotiated solutions, which always preferable for us, but also by imposing peace through strengthening our military capabilities and practice our natural rights to defend our people. You know, James, in the past 24 months, we positively engaged in many peace talks. In all these initiatives, unfortunately, failed because of the lack of will from SAF, which maintain constant withdrawal from all these peace talks. So we thought also the political forces and other Sudanese people to take the responsibility and to move forward and to protect the civilians, to address the humanitarian crisis. James, the RSF controls more than 65% of the Sudanese territory, and the more than 20 million people live in the RSF control. All of them had been deprived from almost everything. So the role of this government is to fulfill this gap and to address the challenges that the Sudanese people are facing. Therefore, we call upon the world to address the humanitarian challenges and also to cooperate with this newly established government to be able to address these challenges.
Let me give you the chance to respond. There are allegations that the RSF has been committing atrocities in the areas under your control. What is your reaction to this allegation?
Of course, we cannot deny the fact that there are serious human rights violations committed during this war. However, the RSF implemented many measures to eradicate these violations. Just for example, the RSF established martial courts to investigate and prosecute the personnel who violate laws, and currently there are more than 2,000 personnel prosecuted out of about 400 RSF uniform who committed outlaw crimes. Also, the RSF formed an investigative committee to investigate in major crimes in Darfur. But, to stop the violations, we have to stop the war. The violations are only symptoms of this devastating war. And this, one of the core objectives of this government is to stop the war, is to work hard with all peace seekers to put more pressure on the other side to either to come to the table and and reach to a negotiated solutions.
Do you think that setting up a parallel government is the best way to stop the fighting?
I believe so. This war has to stop and has to stop immediately. But with the current deadlock and the absence of the will from the other side, we have no choice but to form this government. First, to address the humanitarian challenges and to protect our civilians from the aerial bombardment. So with the government, we will be able to stop these atrocities, of course.
Ezzedine El-Safi is the RSF Senior Advisor for Peace and Humanitarian Affairs. He was speaking with us from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 26. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Hundreds of vendors in Malawi marched to the national legislature in the capital, Lilongwe, on Tuesday to protest skyrocketing prices of goods. Upon arrival at parliament, some protesters began pelting stones at cabinet ministers who were addressing them, forcing the officials to flee for safety. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
During the march, protesters carried placards and sang songs denouncing the administration of President Lazarus Chakwera on their way to parliament to present their grievances to government authorities. Miriam Nyirenda sells second-hand clothes at Tsoka Market in the capital, Lilongwe. She told VOA that the prices of the bales of second-hand clothes have almost doubled, affecting her business, which feeds a family of six.
What we're asking the government is to help us by holding discussions with those that are selling the bills to us, the wholesalers, so that they should consider us when they are making these prices.
Malawians have experienced an alarming price hike of commodities since November, when the government devalued its local currency, the kwacha, by 44% against the US dollar. Nyirenda says as a result, some people have closed their businesses.
They are no longer selling this second-hand clothes. If you look at the price today, you buy the same bale at 400,000 kwacha, then tomorrow the same bale, you're going to buy it at 500,000 kwacha.
Sosten Gwengwe is Minister of Trade and Industry. He told the protesters who gathered at the entrance to Parliament that their grievances are justified and announced that all business licenses for second-hand clothing traders have been revoked with immediate effect. But the protesters were not pleased, saying they needed a more tangible solution that would boost their businesses. The angry protesters later started pelting stones at the cabinet ministers who were addressing them, forcing the officials to flee for safety. Local media reported that one police officer sustained injuries, while a local journalist for Zodiac Broadcasting Station, Leah Malekano, said a stone smashed her smartphone while she was recording the event. Despite the fracas, government authorities resolved to invite leaders of the protests and representatives of wholesalers to a closed-door discussion inside the legislature. Trade Minister Gwengwe chaired the meeting.
We've agreed that the prices for second-hand clothes should go back to the December prices before the volatility started. And going forward, they should be able to remain stable because they'll be getting support from government.
Habib Aliyah, who represented the wholesalers for second-hand clothes.
We had a very good meeting with the Ministry of Trade because our licenses have been revoked. He said that you can open the shop tomorrow morning and the parallel you can apply for the licenses, whoever agrees with this arrangement.
However, many protesters who were waiting for the outcome of the discussions outside the parliament returned home doubting whether the wholesalers would reduce the price of their commodities by half to reflect December's rates. For VOA Africa, I am Lamek Masina in Blantyre, Malawi.
From Europe to North America, nations are tightening their immigration policies. Now, Canada, long seen as one of the world's most welcoming nations, has introduced sweeping changes affecting international students. The reforms highlight a growing global trend toward more restrictive immigration policies. Azuma Kompare reports from Calgary.
Canada is cutting the number of international students it accepts to 437,000, down 10% from last year. Sheikh Omar Kirakoya came to Canada from Burkina Faso less than a year ago. His journey mirrors that of thousands of international students across Canada.
I chose Canada because there were more opportunities in my field.
But it's harder now to stay and work in Canada after graduation. Prospective students will need to show they have more than $20,000 in savings instead of the previous $10,000 requirement. And to work in Canada after they get their degree, students need to be proficient in English or French, and they need to graduate in a field Canada really needs, like science, farming, or healthcare.
When I first left the country, it was to work in mining field. But now with the new immigration laws, I had to change my field of study because I had to adapt to the new laws.
Canadian officials say the new rules are designed to pause population growth in the short term to give the Canadian government time to improve access to housing and health care. With so much uncertainty, students are turning to immigration services and apps like Shira, founded by Bucky Wanda. Her site provides tools that guide students through visa applications, immigration rules, and job searches.
This is the time where a DIY process would not work for you because the immigration is changing per second. So you need to be strategic to be able to say, okay, what are my options?
Amid the uncertainty, Kirakoya says he still believes he can contribute to both his adopted and home countries.
What I plan to do after my training is to gain experience here, look for good opportunities, and after a few years, return to my country, because I want to put what I've learned here to good use in the service of my country.
Wanda points out that international students contribute over $22 billion to Canada's economy every year. And she says reducing their numbers could weaken Canada's economy and access to talent. Arzuma Kompaure, VOA News, Calgary, Canada.
Despite rising uncertainty over winning U.S. support, growing existential questions and ongoing Russian advances, polls find Ukrainians remain generally optimistic about their future. Leslie Bakalets reports from Kiev.
This part of Independence Square in the center of Kyiv used to be a flower bed until 2022. When the invasion began, people started bringing Ukrainian flags here in memory of fallen soldiers. Over 3 years, the number of flags has increased by the hundreds. 16-year-old Polina is here with a friend.
We brought a flag in memory of our uncle.
There is always someone at the memorial. After 3 years of Russia's invasion, feelings are mixed.
Don't ask me how I feel in the third year of the war. I lost my husband. He was in the military.
I feel despair in my body, anger in my head, and I want my husband back. He went missing from the front 3 months ago.
I don't think about politics. I just want everyone to stay alive so this war can be over, so that we can live under a peaceful sky.
That was Kyiv residents Daria, Ludmila and Lina, who declined to give their last names. The non-governmental Kyiv International Institute of Sociology have been working in Ukraine for more than 30 years. Its survey at the end of 2024 suggests most Ukrainians still remain optimistic. Anton Vrushetsky is executive director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology.
More than 80% still believe that Ukraine is capable of achieving success in the war if Western partners properly support it.
A similar study conducted last year by the International Republican Institute finds 88% of Ukrainian citizens surveyed believe victory is possible. But enthusiasm is not as high as it was at the start of the full-scale invasion in 2022. This was to be expected, says Artem Zakharchenko, head of the nonprofit communication analysis team, which has monitored Ukrainians' attitudes on social networks since the first days of the war.
The most difficult thing now is that people don't know what to do to make things better. Right now, a lot of the focus is on Trump and on expectations of what he will do now.
Sociologists also find disappointment, fatigue, and anger are high among Ukrainians, sentiments that are causing some to oppose negotiations. Again, Anton Grushetsky.
There is fatigue, exhaustion, but there is also an understanding that Russia is an existential enemy, and this creates very little room for compromise.
At the same time, polls say people's trust in the armed forces of Ukraine is consistently high at 90%. A U.S.-funded survey by the State Institute of Sociology of Ukraine suggests that patriotism has united Ukrainians during these years. How the country emerges politically is a different question. Sergei Dembitsky is the Institute's deputy director.
Such sacrifices that were made are an indicator of maturity, resilience, and dedication. But when the war is over and we return to our political process, then we will see whether society has grown or not.
Meanwhile, near the memorial, a street musician sings a popular Ukrainian rock band song. It says everything will be fine for each and everyone. Леся Бакалець, VOA News, Київ.
And that's it for this Wednesday, February 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Contact with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
Wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.